Coming up next, it's hour two of the Dr. Future Show.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Why do we never get an
answer? In all fairness, it should be Mrs. Future as well as the co-host for the show.
Thank you, Amy.
You're most welcome.
But you know me, I pride myself on my superpower of being hidden.
Behind the scenes, shall we say.
Yes, I like being in the control pit.
Being in control behind the scenes. Many people like that for various societies.
Yeah, I'm one of them. Don't mind me. I'm just the girl behind the curtain.
Okay, yeah, that's right. She controls the buttons here, so watch out what we say. For this hour, we have Jim Fanaro on. Jim is a long-term anthropology instructor at Cabrillo. I first met him in the early 80s in anthropology, and he's the founder of Contact, which is an international interdisciplinary conference on the future, if you had to describe it in a few words. Jim has published some rather interesting things. Research interests have included a paper called Anthropologists as Culture Designers for Off-World Colonies and on the Cultural Impact of Extraterrestrial Contact. So Jim's professional approach, being in Santa Cruz for so many years, naturally combines the sciences with the arts. He's also a published poet and has won the American Anthropological Association's top prize for poetry with The Dancing Stones of Kalanish. Welcome, Jim, to the show.
Hey, Alan, how are you? Or do I have to call you Dr. Future?
No, you can call me Alan. That's fine. You know, it's because it's...
He answers to both.
Yeah. That you can call me Al. Yeah. So, Jim, before we get into the contact and stuff like that, being an anthropologist and, you know, we've been, you know, as a talk radio show host, we've been grappling a lot with this whole terrorism thing happening in the West and culture. And we're kind of curious of what your perspective is on what's happening in Brussels and Europe and any potential insights you might have from your world.
Well, anthropologists have been studying the interaction between cultures for at least a century, and so this is dead center contact material. Mm-hmm. I think that probably anthropologists would have had a lot to say about all our interactions, that is, U.S. interactions in the Middle East over the last decade or so. I guess we just didn't get asked or didn't, at any rate, get paid any attention to, but a lot of the differences, the difficulties we're facing now, could have been predicted a long time ago. Not necessarily averted, but it was pretty obvious when you go in and break up a system, however much you didn't like it, that was holding things together. Mm-hmm. And you get rid of that, you get the old conflicts back again. They don't go away. And some of the sectarian conflicts in the Mideast are centuries old, 1,000 years old, actually. A policy of New World Order or government building is just not going to work imposed from the outside. Mm. These problems, if they can be solved at all, can only be solved, I think, from the inside.
From within these cultures themselves.
Oh, boy, and that's really your specialty with the scenario building for Contact, which we're looking forward to the Contact Consortium coming up soon.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about the Contact Consortium and its origins? You were the founders of it, I believe. What was your initial was your initial vision?
Actually, I started Contact in 1983, Al, and my original conception of it was that I was teaching a course in anthropology and was finding out that a lot of the kinds of intercultural situations that I was used to dealing with in anthropology were also being dealt with in science fiction. My sort of motto was, anthropologists study alien cultures, science fiction writers create them. So I figured that science fiction writers and anthropologists have a lot to talk about. And so I just thought, well, it would be really interesting to get them together you know, and just let the sparks fly, see what happens.
Well, it does so seem to be the fertile middle ground between fact and fiction, right?
Yeah, and it's why science and art come together in contact, too. It's always been an exciting thing to watch. Bring brilliant people together to let them bounce off one another, and it's wonderful. It gives off sparks, and sparks give off heat and light. So it's always an exciting conference.
So when you first brought them together, was it exciting? Was it anything surprised to you?
It was amazing. I sent out this letter to a bunch of people that I knew in both anthropology and in science fiction, and it was basically an attempt to, as I call it, entice their demons, to see what we could get. And I got cream of the crop, first shot. I mean, I had the first contact, Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle and C.J. Cherry, and actually some of the people that were not present but behind the scenes were Frank Herbert and Ursula Le Guin.
Wow.
So we had these amazing science fiction, and I actually got the ex-president of the American Anthropological Association excited about it. He came. So I was getting top dogs in both fields.
Yeah, it's a pretty fresh idea. Wow. Well, let's talk to you a little bit more about this conference. I've got to go to a break. We're a commercial station here. So we'll be back in a few minutes. We're talking to Jim Fanaro about Contact, a unique interdisciplinary conference bringing together scientists and science fiction writers and artists. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking with Jim Fanaro, anthropologist, many years at Cabrillo College, about Contact, a unique interdisciplinary conference, a cultures of the imagination, if you will. Now, Jim was just telling us about some of the people that actually came together at the first Contact back in 1983.
Real all-star cast.
Yeah, can you mention some of those? Ursula Le Guin, is that you said?
And Frank Herbert, one of my very favorites. And Larry Niven, I mean, wow. That's really stunning.
Yeah, well, and Larry, of course, is coming back this year. But when it started out, as the story is kind of funny, as far as I'm concerned, and I talk about it on the website so that people can go there and look. But what happened was that I was, as I said, I was using science fiction to help me teach science, because the situations that came up in the science fiction were often about intercultural contact, even if it was extraterrestrial. So I see the idea of extraterrestrial contact as being a metaphor for the kind of things that anthropologists do on this planet. Intercultural contact is
sort of Star Trek-esque.
Yes. So what happened is that I was preparing for a class called Science Fiction and Anthropology, and went up on a vacation to Port Townsend, Washington, to see a friend. And I was telling her about the class that I was planning to teach. And she said, well, you want to meet Frank Herbert?
He's the author of Dune, for the uninitiated. Yeah, Dune.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's one of the best examples of a created ethnography that I know of. It's just like the kind of scenarios that we create, except, of course, much more elaborate, because Frank took a big fat book where we only take 3 days. we create a culture every year.
Yeah, we want to talk to you about that too, because what do you do with all these scientists and science fiction writers and artists together? You create a culture. Could you describe a little bit about that process?
Of course. The idea that I have always nurtured with Contact is that everybody's a participant. We have presenters that are invited to give talks, but the atmosphere is very informal, and we try to keep it small, as a matter of fact, a couple hundred people, so that everybody has a chance to talk to. So if you want to go up to Niven and ask him about his latest book, you can do that. Or you want to talk to one of the Mars mission scientists about the rovers or terraforming on Mars, you can sit down and have a beer or a cup of coffee and do that. So the atmosphere is very informal and light. We have a program where people do give talks, and the schedule is, again, listed on the website. But then there's plenty of time outside the talks for informal discussion between people.
Yeah, that's great, because it allows people to explore things at their own pace and from their own understanding. You also create collaborative environments too there, right?
Right. It's going to be mostly on Sunday this year, but there has been a world created by professional scientists, and they're going to bring that world to contact, talk about the world, and then they're going to actually do what I think probably is the most innovative thing that we've come up with at Contact, and that is the idea of an unrehearsed contact scenario between two different cultures. In this particular case, it's two species on the same planet that have had different habitats. The thing is, we play it out right in front of the audience. So the audience gets to see what a contact would be like. And for me as an anthropologist, this makes a lot of sense because the kinds of contact that we get involved with when we go to visit another culture is, of course, unrehearsed also. So it's a very relevant kind of scenario, both for anthropology and for science fiction.
So it sounds a little like improv theater, and people are giving themselves roles as like different species, I guess.
But when you're creating these cultures, you're creating them with real scientific guidelines, though, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's one of our mottos is science as a guide to the imagination. So nothing that can't be justified scientifically is allowed, as it were.
Can you give us an example of that? Like, you have a planet where creatures fly in methane gas, and you need wings that work with methane rather than oxygen, stuff like that?
There are. And as a matter of fact, your audience can go on to our website and follow through some of the early scenarios that we did. And it talks about the scientific background for the world that's created, the life forms that are created, and the cultures that are created. And all of them have to be based upon a justifiable scientific basis. So it's an exercise of the mind, not just of the sensations. We're not interested, for example, in the kinds of scenarios that we find in, for example, the Star Wars bar scenes, where you stick some elephant ears on something and a little trunk and give it color, and that's the alien. our aliens have to have some kind of scientific reason for having evolved the way they do. Yeah. So we go through the evolution. Actually, the way it usually works is that we divide the participants up into two teams, and originally it was a human team and an alien team, and they work in isolation from one another. The one team is creating a future human society of about 100 years in the future, and the other team is creating an alien world and a life form and a culture. And then we put the two together in an unrehearsed improvisation is exactly what it is. Your word was the right one. But interactions between cultures are always improvisations. If we do the best we can, sometimes we're more successful than others. The kinds of cultural conflicts that we talked about at the beginning of our discussion, with terrorism in the world today, it shows the less successful contacts.
Is there any Muslim science fiction writers that you've met?
No, but I'd love to. If anybody out there is listening, I'm ready.
Well, I imagine that some of these improvisational scenarios have erupted in some kind of conflict, and that's been something that was like a teaching situation for you.
Absolutely.
How about...
Some of them aren't successful in the sense that mutually beneficial communication occurs. Sometimes they kill each other. Sometimes happens in contact. Contact is always a risk. You know, if you didn't want to have any risks, you would just stay home and everybody would be isolationists. And that isn't the way human beings work.
Have you ever broached the creation of a religion or spirituality with alien cultures?
Yeah. If the teams decide to do that, that's what comes up in the scenario. We've had a number of cultures that have been based upon their own native religions. And, of course, those, just as happens in real interaction on this planet, those beliefs govern how they behave. So it's part of the scenario, has to be built in. And as I say, some have been more successful than others. I would say probably 75% of the times that we've done this, the contact has been judged successful in the sense that I originally suggested it. But on several occasions, it wasn't. There were casualties on both sides, and it was considered to be, you know, inconsistent with communication.
How serious are your scenarios in terms of, are you working with the premise that perhaps 100 years from now we will be engaging with a non-terrestrial life forms?
Good question. And the answer is that these not only provide thought experiments for professional scientists, but they also outline potential protocols for a real contact situation, whether it occurs on this planet or somewhere else. Again, it's my approach that contact is contact and involves some of the same problems of misunderstandings, of preconceptions, of difficulty in accepting what an anthropologist would perceive as difference as being wrong, which is the way most cultural problems occur, is that people on each side each consider themselves to be doing things the right way, which means that somebody does it differently is therefore, by definition, wrong.
Jim, can you hold on? We're going to go to a break, and can we have you on for another segment?
Okay, we'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Yeah.
Hello, Jim. Looks like it's just me and you. Dr. Future is kind of taking some air. I don't really know. His sense of time is a little out there today.
Well, we all do our part in trying to keep Santa Cruz weird.
That's right. Definitely. Well, you know, I would love to hear a little tidbit from maybe your memoirs of the contacts. Like, which ones have you been most surprised by over the years? And how many have you done since the 80s?
We have done pretty much one every year, Shine, which means we're going on 29 years. So there have been almost 30 iterations, every one of them different, because we start out in a different place every time. Our audience can follow some of those, as I've said, if they're interested in going to the website and looking at the history, because it talks about how it got started. It did, by the way, get started in Santa Cruz. I started here because, of course, this is where I am. And actually, the mayor of Santa Cruz at the time declared contact day on
Oh really, you actually had a contact
day. It was in
83. Hilarious. Hey, listen, we do have a question, a text that came in. This is public radio, so yeah. Alien sex. Somebody wants to know whether or not you ever explored the topic of alien sex. Anything to say on that?
Personally?
Well, I mean, we are a species that likes to think about such things. So I'm kind of curious, you know, if you're creating civilization, you might want to come up with sexuality, it seems to me.
Oh, yeah? Absolutely. It's as important as any other aspect of our experience. Yeah. And I always sort of think of sex as being alien to some degree and exciting for that reason. We haven't had any attempts to perform.
I see. No examples in the spontaneous improv.
In front of the audience.
I see.
Yeah. But I'm not dead yet, and contact isn't over, so who knows what'll happen. Actually, it almost happened the last time.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. You know, what anthropology tries to do and what contact tries to do as a extension of that is to be outside the box, to look at things from the outside and not be, say, put off by cultural differences. And sex is probably necessary for most of the life forms that we know anything about.
As a matter of fact, it's interesting, you know, regarding the Middle East crisis. We were just in District of Columbia speaking at the D.C. Indie Film Festival, and one of the big films there, interestingly enough, was LGBT Arabs, gay Arabs having sex with Jewish lovers in Tel Aviv, and how to tell their parents, you know, how to communicate gay Arabs having sex with Jews to their families.
And, of course, the clandestine issue of the gay Arabs in Gaza being blackmailed to have to pay off people to not reveal it to their families in case they might get killed. It was just a fascinating undercurrent culture, you know?
Yeah.
And yet, you know, when you stop and think about it, sex is one of the great connecting things that goes beyond cultural differences and actually can bring people closer.
Ellen, that's exactly what I was going to point out. Sex can be just as much a matter, a way of bringing people together as it is making them feel uncomfortable about themselves. Much of the interaction that we know about on this planet, for example, the European expansion into North America, was the original connections were by marrying in to a group. And that created a bond that wasn't there otherwise and allowed for more hopeful contact in the future.
Yeah, and allows the next generation to be part of both cultures of their parents.
Exactly, and to be, for that reason, maybe less threatening. Yeah, sex is certainly part of all the scenarios. It's something that they have to deal with because part of the rules of the game are that these cultures, the goal is, by making them scientifically verifiable, they make the cultures more believable. So as these societies are being built, all the major things that we know about that go into making up a society, a culture, including sex, have to be part of it. They have to be integrated.
How about alien technology? Have you seen anything interesting in that department?
Well, sure. One of Arthur C. Clarke's famous statements about that is probably known by many of our audience.
Any technology sufficiently advanced will appear like magic to someone else.
Exactly. Exactly. So the goal is not to really to create a fantasy, but a scientific or technological innovation that could be justified is legitimate. So that there are some surprises that occur because the two teams that are involved do not know the history of the other. So each of them is operating as any culture does, as if it were the only universe that exists. And so the contact between two cultures is bound to come up with surprises.
Yes. Brings me up another issue that I've often heard people quote lately, that if we actually do contact a more advanced civilization than ours, then it's usually not good for the less advanced civilization for the contact, you know, based on the experience of the Native Americans in this country, for example. Is that really true anthropologically?
Yes.
Yeah?
It is.
Not good.
Usually the more technologically advanced society winds up winning the battles, whether they win the war or not, that is in the realm of ideology or philosophy or religion, is another matter. But in terms of original practicalities, yeah. Although some societies have made an aggressive victory into a long-term victory, the Romans are a really good example of that. What they would do is they'd come in and they'd take over militarily, but then what they do is settle their soldiers in the land, make colonies. They would make the process that anthropologists call acculturation, that is the integration of the two different cultures, much easier. They give people in the conquering civilization an investment in the conquered. So over the long run, that civilization lasted over 1,000 years, utilizing basically that colonizing strategy based ultimately on the military, but the military didn't actually have to do that much work once the fighting was over. So there are examples that we can find on this planet where even aggressive victories can ultimately yield a satisfactory society. It happened, really a good example of it was in what we today call France, but Gaul, where by the time the Romans had pretty brutally defeated the tribal peoples there, but within a matter of 50 years or so, the Gauls were just as Roman as the Romans were.
That's this assimilation idea.
Yeah,
in a sense.
And of course, people now speak French, which is an outgrowth of Latin, not out of the Celtic languages.
Now, have you ever seen anyone create new enemies for humankind? Like the Star Trek mythos created the
The Borg.
The Borg, yes, the Borg. Yeah, how could I forget? I got assimilated. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought that up. My thought, by the way, in this context, is called The Evolution of Star Trek as an American Mythology.
Yes, yes.
That resonates so nicely. The aliens often start out as being...
Let's see, we're losing you here, Jim. Did you step away from the phone?
No, there you
I
go.
I didn't, but I've been moving.
Ah,
is this
better.
Okay?
That's good.
Better.
That's good, yeah.
Okay.
So
try again. Star Trek?
The Klingons were the original
That's right.
evil enemy.
Kind of like the Russians in a way. They were thinly veiled Russians.
Very much like the Russians. Yeah. They were indeed. And this was during the Cold War. I mean, this was the perfect enemy.
Right.
Roddenberry had a very regularized set of rules for Star Trek stories. It actually is written up. I don't know whether you've ever seen that, but it's actually a guidebook to how to write an episode for Star Trek.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And his goals, I think, were not simply to formalize the procedure and make production easier, but they also were very forward-looking. So a lot of the themes that have run around in American culture for the last 50 years, like sexism and racism and imperialism. All those things are sort of... They're addressed, and they both demonstrate and reflect changes in American society over the last 50 years.
Interesting. Jim, we have to go to another break. Can you hold on for a couple minutes? We'll be right back.
I can.
Thank you.
Okay, and we also have a caller when we come back, so stay tuned for more of the Dr. Future Show.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking with Jim Fanaro, anthropologist, originally from Cabrillo College and organizer of CONTACT, International Interdisciplinary Conference on the Future. Now, we have a caller, Mrs. Future?
Yes, we do. I'd like to say hello to Mark from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mark.
Mark,
did you have a question for our guest?
Hello there. Well, comment and a question. This is a carryover from a continuation of a call from earlier. It's actually just as well because we have a distinguished guest on and some pretty bright heads and very imaginative and open-minded. And my topic was what I've noticed about a commonality in all these terrorists is that they seem to be drug or deranged minds. And I think one of the beauties of the neuroscience in the modern age is that we're starting to understand what we never knew several years ago is that the mind adapts to drugs, and the drugs change the neurons of the mind, and the people think differently. Although we can't say, although correlation is not causation, there's an amazing correlation between all these terrorists who not, quite often are not very devout Muslims, but they are using drugs, see?
So what about a question here?
Sure. Oh, yeah, well, that was a prelude to my question. So what do you think that the possibility is that we're focusing too much on radical Islam and really we should focus on drug-deranged minds, basically mental illness from the drugs they use?
Well, there you go, Jim. We talked about sex. Now about drugs, one of the other popular topics of our culture.
Okay. Could you rephrase that question for me? I wasn't getting it really clear.
You have a hard time hearing?
Sure. I'm sorry. Basically, the premise is that almost all these terrorists, if not every one of them, is using drugs, whether they're Islamic or not. The list of names is unbelievable. You know, the Kwachis, the Absalom, he's a user of marijuana. And we know in the neurosciences that the drugs can alter the neurons of the brain, affect mood and behavior and general outcomes in a permanent manner rather than temporarily under influence. So my question is, what do you think of the possibility that we're focusing on the wrong aspect, we're talking too much about radical Islam, whereas we should be focused on a more general concept of drug-deranged minds?
Well, I'm not sure whether I can answer your question, but I'll do my best and maybe wind up dancing around it. People don't have to be drugged to act crazy. All they have to be is acting different from what you expect them to be acting like.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly the case that drugs can alter consciousness, but those drugs don't always have to be coming in from outside our bodies. Our bodies produce lots of internal drugs that also affect our moods, our behavior. So a lot of the behavior that seems crazy to, say, Americans that are being performed by people, let's say, in a radical Islam, a lot of that behavior is simply a different perspective on the same thing. In other words, I suppose what I'm saying is one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. So the people that blow themselves up in suicide bombings aren't necessarily any crazier than, for example, Christian martyrs sometimes did in a different line of history.
Yes, yeah, it could be the psychological training that they've received. Like we had one person on who was telling us that the terrorists blow themselves up at very low self-esteem as a result of being shamed all their lives. So it was really about child-rearing practices that created some of these circumstances.
And beliefs that, as one of our guests earlier was talking about, beliefs that violence is actually sacred, and building a cultural belief system where that kind of attitude is sanctioned is bound to give people permission to act on these terrible impulses. You know, otherwise people might have these impulses as some sort of fantasy, like maybe people have suicide fantasies, but they wouldn't act on them without that outside permission and cultural sanctioning.
Yeah, and this is, of course, something that anthropologists have been dealing with as long as they've been studying other cultures than the ones that they were raised in.
Yeah.
There are lots of examples I could give, but basically some things, there are many cultures that believe that killing is not only okay, but it's praiseworthy. So do we simply, without understanding the beliefs behind those, do we simply assume those people are murderers and treat them legally as such? This is not a question that's easy to answer,
yeah,
but it's one that can't be avoided if you're interested in intercultural contact.
Yeah. Now, in terms of science fiction and drugs, Dune comes to mind with the spice. Right. That was an example of where drugs were actually an essential part of the interplanetary civilizations.
Yeah, in fact, drugs were sort of treated as oil, or any kind of scarce commodity is treated in our normal economic culture.
Well, the spice was a kind of a psychedelic that allowed the Space Guild to bend space and time and move the ships between planets. So
right, and it was certainly, you needed money to get spice. So that it's a commodity in many ways, like something that we can understand like oil. I was going to say that the use of drugs to alter consciousness comes up in lots of science fiction. Seems to me that Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land had a good deal to do with that. And Contact has attracted a number of really interesting people, like John Lilly, for example.
Really? That's right. He was, yes, one of the pioneers of psychedelics, really.
Yes, and he came to Contact and he liked it. And so it's not that we can't deal with it in Contact. It's just, it's a sort of a sidelight. Contact, the word, seems to imply that what we're interested in is extraterrestrial contact, but that's not how I originated the word at all. For me, contact had to do with the sparks that fly when different ideas come together. Contact in the sense of ignition.
Yeah.
The way that the World War One planes, you know, they contact and push, you know, that propeller until it caught.
Right.
That's what the contact is about, although it just happens to be very useful in a lot of other respects, particularly having to do with the anthropological basis for the conference.
Yeah, you like to see minds stirred up. You like to see controversy where people are actually engaging each other in an active way. It's like no spectators, kind of like Burning Man in that respect.
Uh-huh. Now, well, yeah, I think that's really, I think, what people get out of the conference and why they keep coming back. It's just for that tie that comes off of that, the bright ideas.
And what comes to mind also is interspecies communication. Like you mentioned John Lilly, he was very much involved with dolphin research.
And whales.
And cetaceans generally. Have you had other interspecies conversations at Contact that you recall?
Almost every year we have some discussion of interspecies communication on this planet. Again, as a model for developing a protocol for dealing with a potential extraterrestrial contact. And some of Lilly's students have been regularly coming to Contact to talk about dolphin, for example, interaction, dolphin communication. And we actually did a scenario a few years ago about that. We had a dolphin trainer who provided a kind of a set of game rules for developing a contact scenario between humans and dolphins.
Wow.
the idea of contact not only doesn't have to be just between aliens. In a sense, each of us is an alien in a way. Each of us has our own personal skin that we live within, and nobody else is in here with us.
So in a sense, it's a way of contacting our inner alien this
right.
way.
But contact between different cultures, contact between different species, we can find models for that right here. We don't have to go anywhere.
Now, this is actually here in the Bay Area. Now, is this open to the public at all? I mean, when there are final minute here, we should really get some of the information on how people can find out more.
Oh, absolutely. I'd like to have a good audience there by that. I mean, I don't want 1,000 people. That would ruin the intimacy that is created with this interactability.
Just you and a few hundred close friends.
All right, so let's give everybody the website and tell them the protocol if they do want to attend.
Yeah.
www.contact-conference, all small letters, .org.
Okay. And then you can get information there about registration and such things there, too?
Yes, and the schedule is on there, too.
Perfect.
It's very inexpensive. I've kept it that way because I want people to be able to come to it.
Well,
long as it remains fairly local, which is mostly okay. It's mostly Bay Area.